Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Get 6 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $2.99 each. Then get flavorful large avocados for 99 cents each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Dragons don't exist. And I hate to say it, but they've never existed. So if they've never existed, why are they in the folklore of almost every culture on Earth, cultures that are separated by continents and oceans, and these dragons share a lot of similarities with one another? Dragon myths can be found in Europe, the Near East, India, the Far East, Mesoamerica, North America, at times when these cultures had no contact with one another. And some of the similarities in these cultures' dragon lore is that they're guardians of springs or other bodies of water, they're capable of flight, they can change shape or suddenly disappear, they have scales, horns, sometimes feathers, they're opposed to thunder or lightning or the sun, they terrify and capture young women, they have fiery breath, they can cause destructive acts of nature like tornadoes or floods or earthquakes, and they're a symbol of war and catastrophe. Lastly, they typically guard treasure. And there are all sorts of theories on why these dragon myths look so similar across cultures. Maybe ancient people looked at dinosaur bones and concluded that these were dragons. Maybe myth of Komodo dragons or whales came back to cultures. Maybe there are genetic memories of lizards that people have turned into these myths. Some think that very ancient genetic memories of dinosaurs embedded in mammals for millions of years have created the dragon myth. Maybe there's an ore myth of dragons that started in ancient civilization, like Mesopotamia or Egypt, that spread across all other human civilization. Lastly, there's one researcher who thinks that dragons are a Jungian archetype, and they're actually a way for ancient humans to make sense of rainbows, of all things. In this episode, we're going to be looking at dragon myths in different civilizations, and theories about where these myths come from, and why it seems that these myths are so similar to one another. Some have argued that dragons really did exist, because how else can you explain that somebody in the Western Hemisphere in South America in 1000 AD could have a similar myth to a medieval European in 1000 AD when these cultures were isolated from one another and had no contact and no ability to spread their myths from one civilization to another? So in our survey of dragon myths, we should probably start out with the culture that's most associated with them and arguably has the longest lasting dragon myth, and that is China. Their dragon myths go back more than 5,000 years. Dragons symbolized in Chinese imagery imperial rule and good fortune. Dragons of Chinese legend dwell in distant waters, and they can fly, even though they typically didn't have wings. They're thought to bring the rain and the fruits of the soil. So in the Chinese zodiac, dragon years are the most notable. And dragons appear in the forms of puppet costumes and New Year celebrations, boats and festive races, and ornamentation on buildings, and they're all over the place. So the dragon symbol is almost as omnipresent now as it was thousands of years ago. The Chinese design influenced dragon imagery in other Asian countries, in Japan and Vietnam, and reaching out to other parts of Southeast Asia. You can find the dragon on the flag of the small Himalayan nation of Bhutan. Now, there are some lines of continuity where we can trace the spread of the dragon myth historically, like in Zen Buddhism and the Kanji script. But the farther back in time, the murkier things get. You see dragon-like monsters show up in the folklore of American Indians, North American plains, and among Mayan and Aztec civilizations. especially the serpent god Quetzalcoatl. Some even argue that you can find a dragon-like creature in the legends of the Inuit in northern Canada. And if dragon myth did start with one civilization and spread out, then you could argue all sorts of different ways of where it came from. Some say that the oldest legends aren't China, but from Mesopotamia, with stories of monster battles being the best candidates for early writings about dragons. In one Babylonian story, there's a serpentine deity monster called Tiamat that emerges from the sea to threaten all of creation with a return to primordial chaos. And the young god Marduk has to take up the challenge to fight him. He slays Tiamat and rescues the cosmos. Similar stories like this are found in the Old Testament. The Book of Psalms and the Book of Job tell how the God of Israel vanquishes the Leviathan, which is something like a whale and something like a snake. So in this version of the dragon myth, it's not so much a symbol of prosperity and power like in China, but more something that a hero has to defeat on his hero's journey. And you see echoes of this in Mediterranean and European traditions. Greek mythology includes battles with serpent monsters also. Zeus establishes his rule over the heavens and the earth by using a thunderbolt to kill Typhon, a dragon creature with snakes for legs that breathes fire. The Typhon myth can be found in other civilizations such as the Hittites. However, the beast found in these ancient myths isn't exactly like our modern-day understanding of a dragon. The word dragon comes from the Greek word drakon, but when the ancient Greeks used it, it seems more like a big snake than our winged dragon that we understand from Game of Thrones and J.R.R. Tolkien. The word drakon meant to watch, and to get an understanding of what ancient Greeks meant with this word, we can look at the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece. This piece of outerwear was under the constant guard of a sleepless dragon. But Jason's paramour, Medea, is able to create a concoction that makes the dragon fall asleep. So in Greek myth, the dragon is a guard of treasure that you find also in the Middle Ages. And in the Middle Ages, the most famous instance of a dragon appears in the legend of St. George. There's a lot of different versions of this legend, but in the classic version, there's a fire-breathing dragon that terrorizes the Libyan city of Selene. The dragon demands tribute and first demands animals, but then he goes to humans, and eventually he demands the princess of the land. St. George rides to town on his horse, and when he learns of what the dragon is doing, he agrees to kill it as long as everyone there converts to Christianity. They do, and he kills a dragon, and this story can be found in all sorts of medieval manuscripts. The legend of St. George can't be traced back to one definitive story, but it seems to be cobbled together from all sorts of different sources. One popular subject in late antiquity for pre-Christian devotion in the Balkans was a rider on a horse that was usually rearing up on its hind legs, and the rider was spearing an animal, and sometimes he was beside a tree that a snake was curling itself around. In the Christian era, the rider was replaced with a saint in the same pose, but now he was killing a snake. Snakes became a shorthand for evil. The tradition of St. George is that he was born in Cappadocia, which is in modern-day Turkey, in the 3rd century AD. He was believed to be a soldier and refused to practice pagan worship and may have burned down a Roman temple before Christianity was legalized by Constantine, and he was martyred for this reason. But there wasn't a connection between him and any sort of dragon story for centuries. Around the year 1000, George emerged as a protagonist in text form from the country of Georgia, and Georgia and England consider him the patron saint. During the era of the Crusades and afterwards, Crusader legends appeared, and Crusader knights learned the legend of St. George and spread his legend from the Eastern Mediterranean to Western Europe, and he became a mainstay of medieval legends. One last dragon myth I want to mention before we get into speculations about the origins of dragons is the Zamaj, the dragon lore from Slavic mythology, which is a little different twist from Western European or Chinese mythology about dragons. And they occupy an interesting place on the axis of belief about dragons. From one hand, you have Eastern Asian countries that regard dragons as symbols of power and strength and good fortune, compared to Western Europe, where dragons are viewed as evil creatures that are foils against a protagonist. But in Slavic folklore, you have the Zamaj. Dragons are viewed as either good or evil, depending on their sex. Male dragons in Bulgarian legends are believed to be the protectors of crops, but female ones are bent on destroying the fruits of farmers' labor. Other Slavic lands consider dragons to be a wicked beast, like in Western Europe. And in Russia and Ukraine, a dragon-like creature is a dangerous beast with three heads that spit out fire. In Serbia, the Zamaj is regarded as a benevolent being like the dragons in East Asia. The creatures are described as having a ram's head and a snake's body. These dragons are said to protect the people from the Azjada, a creature that is thought to bring bad weather and storms that destroy crops. The Zamaj are also thought to take on different forms, including human beings. In their human form, they indulge in their favorite activity, which is pursuing women. There's one other famous dragon I want to mention before looking into theories about the origins of dragons, and that is a monster in Beowulf. Specifically, the character of Grendel. This shows us how ideas of monsters change over time, and what could have been a dragon in the Middle Ages is very different of our idea of a dragon today of Smaug in The Hobbit or dragons in Game of Thrones. Beowulf was originally written in Old English and tells the story of a Scandinavian hero Beowulf and his attempts to aid the Danish king Hrothgar. One of the reasons Beowulf is needed is because he needs to kill a monster that's been plaguing the hall of Hrothgar. The monster is Grendel, who is maybe even more famous than Beowulf himself. The nature of Grendel is never made clear. Some have interpreted him as a giant or a dragon or a Scandinavian monster known as a berserker. He's described as a bipedal brute that has impenetrable scales and spikes in place of skin, and called a shadow walker in the text. The reason he's called that could indicate his preference for darkness and shadows, or could mean that Grendel was initially intended to be interpreted as this. Because the story is set in Scandinavia, some argue that Grendel is a giant or a dragon. Giants are described in Norse sagas as abnormally large bipeds that live in the realm of fire. One giant named Ymir is credited in Norse mythology with creating the initial version of the world from his own limbs. The physical details of Grendel match those of a giant, because he had claws and fangs, and sometimes giants are mentioned as even possessing more than one head. The idea that Grendel could be a dragon falls more within a European interpretation of what dragons were like. That these creatures are covered in scales and they prefer to hide in caves and hoard their treasure from greedy men. But in medieval literature, dragons are more akin to serpents than modern versions we see today. Medieval Scandinavian dragons had legs, which were tiny, and sometimes they had wings and sometimes they didn't. One dragon that gnaws on the Norse tree of life is described as able to fly. But all that to say, the emphasis on dragons as being serpentine doesn't really match up with Grendel's description as being humanoid. And there is another dragon in Beowulf that appears at the end of the story, so it makes it seem less probable that Grendel is another dragon for Beowulf to fight. So Grendel is probably a Scandinavian giant instead. But the fact that we're getting into this just shows how omnipresent dragons are all over the place in just about any culture's myth and folklore you can imagine. Now let's talk about different theories of where dragons came from in terms of myth. A popular approach is to think that they are faulty interpretations of bones or other extant animals. The most popular explanation of dragons is that they are misinterpreted dinosaur bones. Maybe ancient people discovered fossils and misinterpreted them as the remains of a dragon. We have an account from Shang Qu, a Chinese historian from the 4th century BC, who mislabeled such a dinosaur fossil in the Sichuan province. If you look at a fossilized stegosaurus, for example, you see a beast that's 30 feet in length, 14 feet tall, and covered in armored plates and spikes for defense. If you're an ancient person who saw such an unfathomably large creature with a long neck, it's easy to see that your imagination could wander. Maybe that patched together with a pterodactyl, where it's pretty obvious that there are large arms, it could have been wings, and put these different fossils together, and this is where a dragon could come from. And perhaps ancient people invented stories to explain what the beasts were. One dinosaur, the Qijianlong, lived 160 million years ago and measured 49 feet in length. Its fossil has been uncovered in China and probably could have been found by ancient observers too. One paleontologist who studied this fossil, Tetsuto Miyashita of the University of Alberta, wonders what it had been like for ancient people to discover such remains. He writes, "I wonder if the ancient Chinese stumbled upon a skeleton of a long-necked dinosaur, like the Qijialong, and pictured that mythical creature." And there's been evidence that the Chinese have been finding and studying dinosaur fossils as far back as the 4th century BC. Another animal that could be a contender for a misidentified dragon is the Nile crocodile. It's native to sub-Saharan Africa, and it may have had a more extensive range in ancient times, going up the Nile, and perhaps it inspired European dragon legends by swimming across the Mediterranean to Italy or Greece. The largest of all crocodiles, and they can reach up to 18 feet in length. They're also capable of a movement called the high walk, in which the trunk is elevated off the ground. So if you saw a giant lumbering crocodile, and you're a sailor who isn't educated, and sometimes you're out on the seas for a while, your imagination gets the best of you, this is another source that the legend could have come from. If you go further afield, let's go to Australia and take the iguana into consideration. Australia has a number of monitor lizards, also known as iguanas. They're large predatory animals that have razor-sharp teeth and claws and can rend their prey, like a dragon does, and they're important figures in Aboriginal folklore. Some studies indicate that iguanas may have produced venom that caused bite victims' wounds to develop infections after an attack. So amongst Aborigines, at least, this could be a source of the dragon myth. The last interesting source, and this is lesser identified than dinosaur bones or Nile crocodiles, are whales. Some argue that the discovery of megafauna, like whales, prompted stories of dragons. Ancient humans may have encountered whale bones or even encountered a whale washed up on the shore of a beach and would have no way of knowing that these animals were primarily sea-based. They mainly just found their final resting place on the beach. And the idea of such massive creatures could have led people to assume that whales were predatory. Whales were poorly understood for most of human history because they spent most of their time underwater. And if you just saw it sounding as a sailor on the open ocean and saw glimpses of a massive creature, you'd have no idea what you were dealing with. One example in ancient literature of humans trying to make sense of these behemoths is in the book of Job in the Old Testament, where a creature is identified called the Leviathan. And it shares characteristics with the mythological whale sent by Poseidon to attack Ethiopia. Here's how it's described in the book of Job. "I will not fail to speak of Leviathan's limbs, its strength and its graceful form. Who can strip off its outer coat? Who can penetrate its double coat of armor? Who dares open the doors of its mouth, ringed about with fearsome teeth? Its snorting throws out flashes of light. Its eyes are like the rays of dawn. Flames stream from its mouth. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke pours from its nostrils, as from a boiling pot over burning reeds. Its breath sets coals ablaze, and flames dart from its mouth. When it rises up, the mighty are terrified. They retreat before its thrashing. The sword that reaches it has no effect, nor does the spear or the dart or the javelin. Iron it treats like straw, and bronze like rotten wood. Nothing on earth is its equal, a creature without fear. It looks down on all that are haughty. It is king over all that are proud." Another animal that is a contender for being misinterpreted as a dragon are snakes. In ancient Egypt, there was a deity known as Apep, the serpent of the Nile. The giant snake was called the Lord of Chaos, and he was an opponent of light and truth. He was thought to lie just below the horizon, always waiting for his chance to swallow the sun. At other times, he was believed to descend into the underworld to eat the souls of the dead. So he's very different from a traditional dragon. But what he points to is a theory about why the dragon myth is so widespread, and that has to do with Jungian archetypes. David E. Jones wrote in his book, An Instinct for Dragons, that the belief in them points to a perennial fear held by humans. He argues that, like monkeys and dogs, humans or humanoids, or bipedal creatures, are instinctively afraid of snakes and other large predators that are poisonous. James argues that the collective human consciousness invented dragons over the centuries due to this embedded fear that humans have. Just as monkeys show a fear of snakes and large cats, the fear of predators, birds of prey, and elephants has been selected for in hominids. Jones cited a study which found that approximately 39 people in 100 are afraid of snakes, and the fear of snakes is especially prominent in children, which are not conditioned to have this fear. And they have this fear even in places where snakes are rare. We saw that the earliest dragon myths has them look much more serpent-like than later dragon myths. So Jones concludes that the reason dragons appear in nearly all cultures is because of humanity's innate fear of snakes and animals that have been predators throughout humanity's history and in the history of their primate ancestors. Dragons are believed to reside in dark caves, deep pools, wide mountain reaches, sea bottoms, and haunted forests, all places that would have been dangerous for early humans. Others have followed up on this idea of dragons as the embodiment of our unspoken fears. Folklorist Carol Rose discussed in her book Giants, Monsters, and Dragons, an encyclopedia of folklore, legend, and myth, that dragons have composite features from many other beasts, such as the head of an elephant in India, that of a lion or bird of prey in the Middle East, or numerous heads of reptiles, such as serpents. Their body color may range from green, red, and black to unusually yellow, blue, or white dragons. So because they can embody the fears of different cultures, they have different powers in different cultures. They bring on earthquakes in seismically active zones, and they can cause a harvest to fail in places that are completely dependent on rainfall if a harvest comes in or doesn't come in. Zoologist Carl Schuker describes dragons in his book Dragons, A Natural History, that includes giant snakes, hydras, dragon gods, and gargoyles, and more obscure variants like basilisks, wyverns, and cockatrices. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan. And we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So what a dragon can do is adapt to cultural and literary expectations of the era. And you can argue that they continue to do that in movies and TV and role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons. And because they embody man's fear, that's why they're such good enemies in traditional myths, and they're the foil for bold adventurers. You'll see other creatures like trolls, elves, and fairies interact with people. Sometimes they help, sometimes they hinder, but they're not the main primary adversary that needs to be defeated in the hero's quest. And the idea of vanquishing a dragon is considered a critical step for any saint, knight, or even a hobbit in J.R.R. Tolkien's Legendarium. Michael Page and Robert Ingpen wrote in their Encyclopedia of Things That Never Were that the use of dragon's teeth provided a simple method of expanding the armed forces of any country. It was first practiced by Cadmus, king of Thebes. First, prepare a piece of ground as though for sowing grain. Next, catch and kill any convenient dragon and draw all its teeth. Sow these in the furrows you have prepared, cover lightly, and stand well away. They also wrote that veteran warriors were clad in bronze and armed with swords and shields, and emerge rapidly from the earth and stand in ranks according to the way in which dragon's teeth were sown. So in this legend, a dragon's tooth can literally raise up an army. Now, I want to take one more look at theories of the myth of dragons, and also take a step back. These theories that I mentioned here come from nature or psychology, something that's present in all humans around the globe. That's one broad approach to how people understand dragons, but a more standard theory that existed for a long time was that of diffusion, that there was a belief in dragons that started at one point in time in one culture, and it gradually spread around the globe. This approach has a long history. Arguably, it goes back to Charles Gould's Mythical Monsters, published in 1886, and Grafton Elliott Smith's The Evolution of Dragons in 1919, that showed that the dragon myth was a worldwide phenomena. Smith argued that the dragon myth has such a convergence of beliefs that it must have a common origin. He argued that the dragon myth came from the Egyptian priesthood. from the Egyptian mythology, then it spread into the Near East, and then Europe, and then India, and then to China, and eventually reached Mesoamerica. This is an idea that the dragon myth spread by a gradual process, and as a very primitive Silk Road builds up in the 200s BC that connects China to Eurasia, along with trade connections, the dragon myth also spreads. As a result, crude representations of the dragon as a horned serpent in Babylonian conceptions of Tiamat then changes into the spirit of chaos in the primeval ocean and evolves over time into a more elaborate iconography, especially in China. Later writers rejected Smith's Egyptocentric theory of world civilizations, but his general proposal that the dragon myth was invented at one time and then spread and borrowed and changed over most of the globe was mostly accepted by researchers until fairly recently. But the alternatives are tricky because then if we propose a theory of independent development all over the world, then why would dragon myths repeatedly have some of the same characteristics over and over again? That around the world, dragons are associated with waterfalls and pools and caves and being controllers of rain and being serpents and having horns and feathers and bodily attributes, characteristic of warm-blooded animals while having the body of a snake. It's for all these reasons that researchers have challenged the cultural diffusion theory of dragons and instead suggest that it's a faulty interpretation of a biological organism that I mentioned earlier. But I haven't mentioned some more out there theories that I think are worth exploring, and Robert Bluss, in his article The Origins of Dragons, goes into all these different ones. Dragons are often assumed to be mental constructs inspired by discovery of fossilized eggs or bones of dinosaurs. And there's a variation of this theme that the dragon motif arose due to direct observation of biological creatures that are unknown to science. Essentially, people saw a Loch Ness monster or a Bigfoot that we haven't discovered, but you have to assume that these actually existed and that people saw them and mistook them for dragons. So this is sort of a double leap of logic. There's another variation of this idea that was proposed by Carl Sagan in 1977 that I think earns most points for originality, and he concludes the following. The pervasiveness of dragon myths in the folk legends of many cultures is probably no accident. So by way of explanation, he asks whether dragons might reflect a genetically encoded memory of dinosaurs from the remote pre-human past. He continues, is it possible that dragons posed a problem for our proto-human ancestors of a few million years ago, and that the terror they evoked and the deaths they caused helped bring about the evolution of human intelligence? Could the pervasive dreams and common fears of monsters, which children develop shortly after they are able to talk, be evolutionary vestiges of quite adaptive, baboon-like responses to dragons and owls? So what his point is that dreams of monsters may have been adaptive in their usual biological sense of giving a survival advantage to mammals. If a mammal dreams of a monster and awakens before a large predator arrives, then they're less likely to be eaten by those which fail to have such dreams. As a long-term consequence, the propensity for the mental representation of dinosaur-like predators to persist is selectively fortified by differential survival, and this leads to a psychological reflex of imagining something like a dinosaur-like predator that could be a dragon. But if we're going to believe this argument, that we have to assume that 65 million years ago, the rodent-like mammals that eventually led to humanity along typical evolutionary lines was somehow preserved in genetic memory for a very, very, very long time, that gives modern humans an accurate mental image of the dinosaur-like antagonists that terrorize our Cretaceous ancestors. This is a pretty big leap, and that's a gigantic step from the idea that because humans are instinctually afraid of lizards, then dragons are a natural extension of that, to the idea that 65 million years ago, distant mammal ancestors encountered dinosaurs, and this encoded into a fear of dinosaur-like creatures that's now our fear of dragons. That's a pretty big leap right there. So let's leave behind the idea that a dragon is symbolically equivalent to a physical phenomena, and let's look at theories that the dragon is symbolically equivalent to some psychological force. Writers who follow this line of reasoning suggest that dragons began when primitive men who were unlearned in natural laws, which we now account for the weather or other phenomena, imagined the varying moods of the weather to be the result of supernatural powers that were struggling somewhere else, on one side for good conditions and on the other side toward destruction and chaos, whether it's gods or demons or whatever. A very different approach to the symbolism of dragons came from psychologist Carl Jung. In one passage in an article he wrote in 1956, he described the dragon as a symbol of the unconscious, calling it perfectly expressing the latter's sudden and unexpected manifestations, its painful and dangerous intervention in our affairs, and its frightening effects. In other writings, he speaks of the dragon as the terrible mother or the devouring mother. It's an archetype of the unconscious, which represents the dark side of the maternal persona, and as representing the visionary experience of the alchemist, he writes. But these are still general explanations that dragons are mystical archetypes and obscure references to clouds or water, and they don't really help us in explaining any of the relevant observations of why dragons appear in so many different cultures. So if they didn't spread by diffusion, if they're not just the construct of pure imagination, then where do they come from? Robert Bluss proposes his theory by starting at an interesting place, and that's by connecting dragons with waterfalls. He notes one 1922 research study by an ethnographer that commented that Indians of French Guinea imagine that each waterfall had a guardian in the shape of a monstrous snake that lied hidden under the eddy of a cascade, but is sometimes seen to lift up its huge head. In one part of French Guinea, called Basuto Land, there are two rivers that spray into vast chasms hundreds of feet deep, and the Basuto tribe fears to approach the foot of these huge falls because they think that a spirit in the form of a gigantic snake haunts the cauldron which receives the falling water. In an 1851 account by Lewis Henry Morgan, who observed the Iroquois, he described a Seneca legend about the horned serpent. Hanno, an assistant of the Great Spirit, was responsible for the formation of clouds and rain and was a keeper of thunderbolts. He was also a guarantor of fertility. In one account, he made his abode in a cave behind Niagara Falls. There are other accounts, too, that connect a dragon-like creature to a waterfall, but one very good point of analysis is the rainbow serpent myth of Australia. This myth was first made generally known through the work of Radcliffe Brown in 1926 and 1930. The rainbow snake of Aboriginal Australia is described as a gigantic snake whose body arches across the sky as the rainbow. He's known as Taipan among one tribe and is associated with the gift of blood to humankind, and controls the circulation of blood as well as the menstrual cycle of women. Medicine men and rainmakers invoke Taipan by using quartz crystals and seashells in their rituals. And there are similar myths in places as far away as Haiti, where amongst one tribe there was an annual pilgrimage to a waterfall in the mountainous interior of Haiti, where supplicants of the voodoo religion seek the blessings of the waters watched over by Aida Wedu, the rainbow, who arches over the falls, intertwined with her consort Dambala, the serpent. So, in other ethnographical accounts of folklore in tribes and other groups, there have been connections made between rainbows and dragons, and this has been made explicit by Robert Bluss in his article, The Origin of Dragons, who thinks that dragons are reactions and understandings of what rainbows are. He notes that rainbows are most commonly represented in folk tradition in one of four ways. First, as a celestial bow. Second, as a bridge between heaven and earth. Third, as a belt, scarf, or other article of apparel of a deity. And fourth, as a giant snake. The most common view is that the rainbow is a giant snake, which either drinks water from the earth and sprays it over the sky, making it rain, or that it drinks rain from the sky, thus causing it to stop. These variants of the belief are found all over the world. It can be found in folk belief among the Chinese of Lanzhou in the Gansu province. Or there's a Javanese conception of the rainbow that it has the body of a serpent, which stretches itself above the island of Java, ending in two heads of deer or cows, one of which drinks water from the Java Sea, the other from the Indian Ocean. So Blust argues that the natural basis for the universal belief in a rainbow serpent is clear. Throughout humanity's history, it's tended to animate the forces of nature, and if a rainbow is to be compared with an organic being, its shape and coloration suggests a serpent. However, a rainbow is an evanescent phenomenon. It appears and then disappears. So any explanation of it as a spirit snake poses a problem. When sun and rain try to vie for control of the sky, the rainbow serpent is visible in the sky, but where is it at other times? Descriptions of the rainbow as a gigantic celestial snake depicted as rising or descending to a spring, lake, river, or a cave. In this conception of the rainbow, it assumes two distinct forms. A celestial form, in which the water serpent is temporarily aroused and visible in the sky. And second, a terrestrial or aquatic form, in which the same creature appears as a guardian of the springs. So this is an interesting theory, but if a dragon is associated with a rainbow and rain, then why does a dragon breathe fire? Blust argues that this also can be explained by a traditional society's understanding of what a rainbow is. In the folklore of many societies, the end of a rainbow was thought to be a place of spontaneous combustion, where there was a raging fire that was going on. The Toba Batak of northern Sumatra associated rainbows with epidemics and fires. The Chontal of southern Mexico hold that the half-rainbow is an evil woman who causes fires. And one Ugandan tribe says that if a rainbow settles on the trees, it will burn all the leaves. And in some cosmologies, rainbows and thunder and lightning are symbolically opposed. The latter gives rain, the thunder and the lightning, and rainbows burn it up. Some also think of a rainbow as being formed by two intertwining serpents, two aquatic serpents, and when they join together in the sky, the fire they emit burns the earth. The natural basis for this belief appears to be the idea that the rainbow drives away or burns away the rain, since it appears in sun showers at the end of a storm. So that's one explanation of why someone think that dragons are fire-breathing. All right then, well, why do dragons always guard treasure? If we accept the rainbow theory, then we can consider that typically pots of gold are considered to await somebody who can reach the end of a rainbow. This belief at first appears to be little more than a quaint invention in Celtic folklore, but the association of gold with the end of a rainbow is found in very different separate regions. On the island of Lembata in eastern Indonesia, the rainbow for the people of Kedong is associated with gold, with springs, and with snakes. Among the Mam of Todos Santos, Mexico, when a rainbow appears, the god of a particular mountain is pointing down to where gold is hidden under the earth. Among the Merle in Sudan, the rainbow is a large dragon-like snake which sleeps in a cave when not flying in the sky. It's a bad thing that kills people, and it has a gold stool which it uses for sleeping in its cave. So if dragons are associated with rainbows, then they could also be associated with the idea that there's gold at the end of a rainbow. If the end of the rainbow is believed to touch a terrestrial water source, typically a spring or a river, and unlike most metals, gold is commonly found in small amounts in river washings where it can easily be seen with the naked eye. For this reason, gold was the first precious metal known to early man long before metallurgy, which is part of the reason that gold appears so much in different myths around the world. Since a rainbow touches down in a spring or river, its end covers a place where gold is found. And since the rainbow is a giant serpent which guards springs and rivers when it doesn't appear in the sky, then you could deduce that it guards the gold found there. So if you follow Blust's logic and discard the idea that dragons are arbitrary creations of the human mind that spread from a single center of origin or some sort of primordial psychological response to something we fear, then explanations of dragons being symbolic of rainbows could make sense. Where dragons are products of rational pre and scientific speculation about the world of real events. Now, whether or not this theory is true, and there are lots of theories about where dragon myths come from, people did believe that they existed for a very long time, and people made use of dragons as well. They were even used in medicine in clever ways. There's a group of fossil specimens that appears in ancient sources over and over again called glossopetrae. And in the English term, this is translated as dragon tongues. These could be shark's teeth that washed up on shore, but ancients thought that they were petrified tips of a dragon or serpent's tongue. Because of their symbolic role in old traditions, ancients viewed glossopetrae as important ingredients for powerful charms and antidotes against poisons and snake bites. Locals in Malta believe that glossopetrae originated from the tongues of serpents that St. Paul transformed to stone when he visited the island, as accounted in the Book of Acts, that symbolized the triumph of good over evil. Ancient Roman philosopher and naturalist Pliny the Elder believed that glossopetrae originated from space and believed that dragon tongues rained from the heavens during lunar eclipses. In Chinese medicine, fossils were considered to be dragon bones and also used. Dragons were venerated as ancestral deities symbolizing prosperity or divine might or wisdom. So these bones were believed to contain powers to do such things as restore youth, heighten sexual performance, give longevity, cure illnesses, and other terrific claims. So dragon bones could be a wonder drug. So it's impossible to actually pinpoint down where the dragon myth comes from, but because it's such a universal story, I think it really does speak to something universal about the human experience. Okay, so that is all for today. That's today's episode. Thank you for joining me. First off, I want to give a shout out to the Spy Masters for the Knowlton's Rangers. Vic Austin, Chris, Rob Matlock, Alan Baker, Beverly Ingle, Jake Harrington, Todd Warren, William Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Daniel Lawson, Marlene, Michael, Tim Clark, David Powell, Moondoggy from Ohio, Melissa, Christopher Main, Carl from Norway, and Baron Fraser. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers, go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplug to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplug to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605 and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.